court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Schmerl. And I am just a dude.
Tommy, you're looking a little sweaty over there.
Well, I had to get a little pool work done before we got started here. But pretty soon, I'll be able to pay people to take care of that for me.
Why is that?
Well, I got this great notice and via fax that came in to me in the middle of the night on a Monday night. And it's from Mendelis Abogadis, which you tell me Abogadis means lawyer or something like that.
I believe so. That's the Spanish word for lawyer.
I mean, it came in over the fax, and it came to me, and the guy says his name is Felix Mendel, and he's a partner at Mendel's Abogadis LLP, a Spanish-based law firm, and he's letting me know that there is an unclaimed permanent life insurance insured for $7,950,000, and it's in a company in London. And the policyholder, a late Michael Smurl,
uh-oh,
I wonder where they got that name, who worked with the energy company in Africa, he died in an accident, and they can't find any of his heirs, and it seems they located me.
It sounds like a little take on the old Drake scheme we were just talking about last episode.
That's what I thought was so funny, because I got this the night or the next morning after we released that episode, and I thought, yeah, it's a new version. Here's what I find interesting about it. First of all, it was faxed.
Yeah.
How many important documents with millions of dollars at stake do you fax to people?
Oh, countless.
Then you've got this form letter, and you see it's got that big blank spot where it's Smurl is typed in there. So Michael is evidently the generic first name they're using, but it's all in a different font. And then Smurl is in a separate font from that.
Let me examine this document.
And they put Smurl in there and then faxed that to me. And I'm sure none of those numbers are right. And I'm sure that there's something I've got to pay for taxes and everything to get all this going so I can get my $7 million.
Yeah.
As they've worked so hard to locate me.
Michael Smurl, who worked with energy company in Africa and Europe, he died in an accident of dysentery 7 years ago.
I think you added that part.
It does say.
He was associated with Drake.
It does say he died 7 years ago, though.
Yeah, it does say he died 7 years ago. But he's now, I guess I shouldn't worry because the letter does state this is 100% risk-free.
There you go.
So it's got to be good, right?
Yeah, well, probably the way that scheme works is they either you need to send them money for some sort of some pittance, just a cut through the red tapes to make sure they can get the money to you.
Yeah, or just a few thousand.
Or alternatively, they'll send you a check for that amount and say, hey, I need you to write me a check to reimburse me from it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So either way, you know.
Either way, it's just another twist on that Nigerian prince scheme.
You should, or the Drake scheme. Drake scheme, is it?
Yeah, I guess it was the original Nigerian prince.
You should write them back and see what they say.
I don't think I'll fax them back.
You should. There's this one website, I think it was called, oddly enough, like Red Hot Chili Paste or something like that. And it was this guy who pranked these Nigerian pranksters via fax.
Uh-huh.
He was Australian, and I think he did it a lot in the 90s. And there were some really, like, just epic conversations going back and forth via fax to these scammers. It's pretty funny.
The only thing that never ceases to amaze me is that there must be people that fall for this. Otherwise, they'd have no incentive to continue doing it. Because if they did it for a year or so and nobody ever responded back, they'd probably go out of business.
They're playing the long game.
Yeah, but apparently there's people that respond to it. They want their $7 million. They got that blank spot. Their last name was stamped in there just like mine was.
Well, whenever you get that money, let me know.
Yeah, I will. Don't hold your breath.
As an attorney,
keep tending that tree.
As an attorney who consulted you on this, I demand a third.
Okay, you can have a third of whatever I get out of it, including the debt.
I think I'm gonna get some sweat off you right now because he's pretty sweaty.
It's hot out there.
It is. So this episode is not about schemes. It's not about
schemes, scams, and Abogadis.
No, it's not about that. It's actually going to be about non-competes. And this was suggested by Lindsay de las Alas. A-L-A-S is the last name.
Alas. Lindsay de las Alas.
De las Alas.
Alas, I knew her well.
And she wrote onto the Facebook page, which if you're not a member of the Quarter Point Facebook page, you really should be.
And besides, you might get to be lucky 1,000. We're creeping right up on 1,000.
We are. And she wrote in, she said, we don't often read the exact verbiage of the request, but I thought this was kind of a good one. Said, my husband and I have both experienced legal issues from non-compete clauses in employment agreements during our careers. We live in Indiana, and in our state, non-competes are almost always unenforceable. But that doesn't stop people from threatening to sue them. What do y'all think? Well, it really just depends. All right, that's the episode. Question
Thanks
answered.
Thanks for joining us. What about the sponsor? We forgot the sponsor.
Well, first of all, you might be asking yourself, what is a non-compete? Well, a non-compete agreement...
It'd be me in a race.
Right.
With
now.
With two bad knees, I'm a non-competer.
A non-compete can either be a standalone document or it can be incorporated into some sort of employment agreement. And sometimes they're called covenant not to compete or a restrictive covenant is some different terminology for it. And it can be a standalone agreement, like I said, or a clause in which basically one party agrees not to enter into or start any similar profession or trade in competition against another party. Usually it happens with an employee and an employer. They have the employee sign some sort of non-compete. So that's basically what a non-compete is.
Okay. I can think of two instances in my business ownership career where I should have had people sign non-competes, and I failed to do it, and it bit me.
I can think of one, I think. but yeah, they are a good tool for...
Tool is right. They were a tool.
they are a good tool to keep somebody from basically... jettisoning off from a business and taking all the client base with them. So
I've always heard people say that most non-competes are non-enforceable, just kind of like what was insinuated in the Facebook post.
Right.
But there's got to be something to it, or you businesses wouldn't waste their time continuing to do it.
Well, like I said, it depends, and it really depends on state by state. There are some states which do not allow them. There are some states which allow them and allow them with gusto. So it just really depends on where you are. I'm going to get into a little bit of the kind of the different extremes of them, but first I want to go a little bit about the history of it.
All right.
So
we're going back in the Wayback Machine now.
Back in the Wayback
Machine.
Sherman
and Peabody.
So it dates back to Dyer's case.
Dyer Straits? Money ain't for nothing if the chicks are free?
Yeah. Non-competes ain't for nothing if the job's for free or something. I don't know.
Leave your job.
Should have thought that out. We'll have to edit that back in later.
Okay. A smart, witty saying.
Yeah.
Snappy.
We'll take care of that in post-production. That's where most of the magic happens anyway.
Postpartum.
So it dates back to Dyer's case in 1414, English common law. And essentially, under English common law, you could not enforce non-compete agreements because of their nature of restraints on trade. So generally, that was kind of frowned upon. You didn't want to restrain trade. You wanted to let people conduct business as they wanted to. So, and that pretty much remained unchanged until about 1621, when a restriction that was limited to a specific geographic location was found to be an enforceable exception to the previous absolute rule. So they said, well, you know what? You can do what you want to do as trade-wise as far as what you want to do for work, but you can't open up a pie shop right next to the pie shop you just left because, you know, that's not cool.
Because there's only so many pie purchases to go around.
That's right.
And it will ultimately sink the entire pie market.
And then eventually, about 100 years later, the exception kind of became the rule in the designated the watershed case of Mitchell v. Reynolds. We all remember where we were when that happened back in 1711. And that basically was the framework for our modern analysis of enforceability of non-compete agreements. And as I said, there's no, well, I didn't really say this yet, but there's no federal law, so it really does vary state by state. So, but that's kind of the history of them. They were a no-no, and then kind of like a so-so,
yes.
And then kind of a yes-yes. So, yeah.
Because everybody wanted a piece of the pie.
That's right. You got to have your piece of the pie. So, have you ever signed one before?
I've never signed one before, no. I've never been that important, I guess. You got to have an important position and have to have something of value that you would take with you if you left. And, you know, I never had anything of value.
You would think so. But I'm going to get into some examples of that where that might be a little bit questionable later on.
Oh, okay.
So Now, as I said, it's not they're not allowed in every state. Some states, actually, they're not enforceable, in California especially. Actually, even ones that are entered into in a different state. So, for example, if you enter into one in one state where it's allowed, and then you try to enforce it in a California court, they may not enforce it, may not give full faith and credit to the other state's laws. So that's one question. That actual issue itself has not been decided by a court, but that could be a possibility. So California is extremely anti non-compete clauses.
That would seem strange.
Yeah.
It would seem they'd have a lot of insider secrets and trade secrets and things like that that would need to be protected. I mean, industries that would have that kind of thing.
Yeah. They just, it's outlawed, I believe, in their constitution. And they just said, you know what, we don't like them. So,
I mean, it'd be like West Virginia, where you don't need them because, like, you can't go compete for somebody else because you know where the coal is. Everybody knows where the coal is. It's at the bottom of the mountain. That's where you always find the coal.
It's right underneath you.
We all know that. Golly.
Now, in California, they are allowed in actually just a couple circumstances. And that's whenever the owner of a business is selling a business, or a dissolution of a partnership or a company. So, if you think about it, that really makes sense. Because if you sell your business to somebody, you don't want to have the person who you bought it from to turn around and open up the same exact business right next to you with the same clients. Because if they have to, who they're going to choose from, they'll go to the old person probably. So,
right. That's one of the things that I read in here that was about non-competes. And that was one of the things they said, is that if you ever purchase a business, one of the things that you absolutely should do is make the people you buy it from sign a non-compete.
Oh, yeah.
So they won't turn around and open one up. And, you know, we've had a few instances, I can't think of what they were right off, where we've talked about on the podcast for other you know, topics, that people sold businesses and then went right back into the business, you know, just down the street.
Yeah.
Right after they sold their business, or they were forced to sell it or something like that.
Yeah.
And then they went right back into it. It's like, I remember thinking at the time, well, that's kind of shady.
I tell you what, I've had actually two or three cases like that when I practiced in Florida with sales of businesses that there was a non-compete and somebody decided to just rub their nose at it or whatever, thumb their nose at it, rub their butt on it. I don't know, one of those expressions. But anyway, they just said, hey, you know what, I don't really care, and then went ahead and did what they wanted to do anyway in violation of that non-compete.
Well, so, the problem is, of course, you'd have to have a long, drawn-out court case, most likely, to get it all decided. By then, they're already established and in business, and then what are you going to do? You think they're going to shut the business down?
It could be. The one that I always drafted basically said that you consent to the filing of an immediate injunction. So, like, on a preliminary basis. So, it would be kind of...
Cease and desist.
Yeah, it would be kind of similar to that. So, the actual agreement had verbiage in there which said that you understand that they would be seeking an immediate injunction right away. So they wouldn't, like, they'd have to draw out and win a case, because whenever you go for injunctive relief, you can do like an emergency injunction where the court makes a first determination ruling on whether or not to enjoin someone from doing a certain action. And then basically they're stopped at that point from doing it
until it can be determined.
But the reality of the situation is that most of the time, if you win a preliminary injunction, that's pretty much how the court's going to rule later on, too, for the most part. It's not an absolute. I would say probably 85-90%. That's kind of the way it works. But
unless something else is brought to light.
Exactly. So, and oftentimes, whenever you have these kinds of situations, it's very clear-cut. The person signed it, they're doing the same kind of business, and it seems that clear, then the court usually enters it right away. So, now, as I said, when I practiced in Florida, non-competes were everywhere. And that was one of the states where they're really, really there a lot. So, do you know one profession where there are not non-competes?
Law firms.
Exactly. Lawyers
took
do
a
not
stab at it.
Lawyers do not have them.
Because they'd have too much fun suing each other.
In fact, under ethical rules, it's usually unethical to have another lawyer sign one.
And in other words, so if a lawyer wanted to leave a law firm and go to another law firm, that's okay. There's no restrictions on that.
No. And they could, the clients have a right to choose who they want to be their attorney too.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that is because, well, number one, lawyers write the laws and they're pretty smart, so they didn't put themselves in there. And number two, because under the U.S. Constitution, you have a general right to choose who you want your attorney to be. So it's kind of almost like a constitutional right, I think.
Yeah, and so you'd be depriving them of something.
Yeah, so I think that's probably the actual basis for it. It's more of a constitutional right to choose your attorney. So it would be kind of bad to say that you don't get to choose the attorney you want because he signed some sort of piece of paper with his prior boss.
Now, what if, say, the guy knew that he was going to be leaving and, like, a client came along where he was at and he hadn't gone to his new law firm yet, and he, while he was still working for the first employer, he kind of, like, nudged the guy towards where his new employment was going to be, but he was still actually under that one. Would he be liable for anything there?
No, I think it happens a lot, actually.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, attorneys have certain clients, and the client feels very comfortable with that attorney. And if that attorney leaves and goes to a different firm, usually the client will follow the attorney. So, just one of those things.
Well, all right. So, it's a legal free-for-all when it comes to changing law firms.
It is, but I think it a bit more civilized about it, maybe. I don't know.
Well, there has to be some kind of advantage to it. You're not just going to do it willy-nilly.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the use in that?
Yeah, and you know, you do that a couple times, you're not going to have a firm to jump to because nobody's going to want you to come there.
That's right.
So I actually read an article.
He's a firm jumper. He's a firm jumper.
That in 2014, there was an article in the ABA Journal about an Indiana lawyer, and the lawyer was reprimanded for that exact situation. This lawyer had hired an associate and had him sign a non-compete, and it was a Social Security disability firm. And he had him sign an agreement that basically said if he left the firm, he wouldn't practice disability law for the 2 years following the end of their relationship. So he fired the lawyer in 2013. I think he'd been practicing there about 7 or 8 years at that point. And then sent letters out to the associate's clients saying that he would be taking over with the representation of those clients. And so he was actually reprimanded for doing that. So
that was a legal no-no.
Yeah.
Can't do it. Can't enforce it.
Yeah. But as I said, it's kind of a good suggestion because I've litigated and drafted these kinds of agreements quite a bit in the past. So when I saw someone suggest it, I was kind of like, oh, yeah, we can talk about that. Why haven't we talked about that before? So as I said, these usually take the form in some sort of employee-employer type relationships. And oftentimes, the employer will have the new employee sign one of these things when they first start working. Like it's part of the whole packet you sign. I would say that happens about 85% of the time. So now there's some difference based upon when you sign these kinds of agreements about how enforceable they are. And I want to talk about that. But I think before that, we have some possible motions before court today.
Why, yes, Your Honorable Legal Ship, sir. We have a...
Legal Ship, sir?
Yes. We would like to approach the bench to pay for court costs, if it please the court, Your Honor, Your Good Ship.
Well, I'm not quite an honor yet.
All right, you're an honorable being.
All right, sounds good. Who do we have on the docket?
On the docket today, we have our good friends and good sleepers at SleepNumber.com.
It is time for their semi-annual sale.
That means they do it, what, twice a year? Once a year?
Semi.
Semi every once in a while?
Semi.
Like a truck semi?
Yeah, every now and then.
Every now and then, it's a truckload sale. It's a semi-annual sale. They do it whenever they feel like it.
I think it's twice a year.
Twice a year.
I guess.
Semi-annual.
Semi-annual sale. So maybe you've heard us talk about the amazing Sleep Number 360 smart beds. They're so smart, they respond to your every movement and automatically adjust to you.
The great news is their latest smart beds are even more comfortably priced during their semi-annual sale. And that's going on right now, so don't wait for the next semi.
That's right. It's going on right now. We just told you that. So
catch
listen
that
up.
Semi.
So many couples disagree on mattress firmness. Sleep Number beds let you choose your ideal firmness on each side, so it's just right for both of you.
So you both get the right amount of firmness.
Yep.
In whatever area that may be.
Yep.
You can actually feel how it contours to your neck, shoulders, back, and hips. Relieving pressure points for more proper spinal alignment.
There's even an adjustment for snoring. How great is that?
It's greater than a CPAP. Now, come in now during the semi-annual sale, which we've already discussed how often that is, and you're probably as confused as we are, to see the latest Sleep Number 360 smart beds with special Memorial Day savings. up to $700.
There are more than 550 Sleep Number stores. Visit sleepnumber.com/court to find the store near you.
And start sleeping firmly.
So as we were going into the actual covenants not to compete, as I said, they're called lots of different things, but that's what I always called them.
A covenant. Sounds like you're entering into something with the devil or something.
Kind of. Maybe it is. I don't know. Depending on who your employer is.
He'll better fiddle a gold against your soul because he thinks he's better than you.
Just don't go fiddling next door trying to steal his business.
Oh, yeah. That was that case you cited there. And he came and he called for a fiddle.
That's right.
And he said, I don't have a fiddle. He called for his fiddlers three.
So as I said, it can vary state by state quite a bit. As I said, there's some interesting things about it. At least I think they're interesting, and I hope you do too.
Well, I'll think they're interesting if you tell me, Mike.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about them is that, like any agreement, it has to be supported by consideration.
Consideration.
Yes.
You have to think long and hard and considerately.
No, that is not what consideration means in the terms of an agreement.
Oh.
The consideration means...
That's only in a marriage, huh?
Yes. Sometimes. don't get me started.
You know more than I do.
Consideration means that sometimes... they're not. You got me all flustered here.
I've got the quality, you got the quantity.
Consideration means that something of value is exchanged. So all agreements basically have to have that. So if you see something is basically says that, like you have a contract and it says that $10 on the top. You ever seen that before?
A contract with $10 at the top?
Yeah, it says like basically for good consideration of $10 of which is noted and received or something like that.
The one that's really weird is for consideration of a peppercorn.
Yes. Well, see, you remember the theory.
I remember the theory of the peppercorn.
That's right.
It took a couple of tries there before it finally sunk in.
Well, the theory of the peppercorn is that to have adequate consideration for a contract, there has to be something exchanged. It could even be a mere peppercorn. So,
can it be sexual favors?
That would be illegal, so the contract would not be enforceable.
Oh, okay.
That would defeat the purpose of the contract.
You just said something had to be exchanged. I was just, yeah. You know, just theorize. Hypothetical, if you will.
I'm pretty firm on the fact that sexual favors cannot be exchanged.
You're pretty firm on that?
That's right.
Is your mattress as firm as you are? Because Sleep Number has your mattress if it's not.
So most states seem to be in agreement that if you have a non-compete, there has to be some sort of consideration for it. Now, if it's entered into whenever you are hired for the job, then actually the hiring of the job itself is what the consideration is. So if you sign like a non-compete at the very beginning of your employment, that is the consideration that is used for that agreement.
That's what they gave you, and well, that's what you gave them is the non-compete, and they gave you a job.
Yeah, so that is the consideration for it. Now, there are some outliers out there, I believe, and I seem to remember I've looked at this issue before, that even if it is at the time of hiring, there has to be some other consideration, too, for a separate agreement like that. So basically, if the employment contract itself has it incorporated in as a clause, then that can be the actual consideration can be the employment. But if you sign an employment contract, then they also have you sign a separate agreement, which is like some sort of non-compete, there might need to be a separate consideration for that agreement, because you could argue, you know what, that's a separate agreement. So, and that's going to be highly litigated by different states' laws and different statutes and case law about how that comes out. Now, most states do seem to agree that if you enter into a non-compete after you're hired, there has to be some extra consideration for that separate agreement. It's because you've already been hired on. This is a job you already have. Now they're asking you to do something different above and beyond just taking the job. They're asking you to sign this non-compete.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I looked at, that it said they can be voided if you were asked to sign it after you were already working for them, unless they gave you some type of further consideration. And they said that, for example, it would be more money, new job responsibilities or titles, new benefits, or a change from an at-will to a contract employee status.
Yeah.
And so it said that the additional consideration does not have to be of tremendous value. It must provide a real benefit that the employee was not otherwise entitled to.
Here, take this peppercorn and put it on your salad.
And don't go to work for anybody else. Okay, thank you, sir.
One interesting question that I thought of was that if a business was sold, So basically, if you had a non-compete for this one business and that business was sold to a new company, about whether or not that non-compete would still be enforceable. And I think it would probably would be, unless the new company was basically a different entity in and of itself. Like, so basically, if they dissolved the old corporation and then essentially hired the new employees with a new corporation, then it could possibly be a new non-compete. But if they're essentially taking over the same business, then I think it would still be in effect. But that'd be one of those things where you'd probably have a little bit of space to kind of argue and wiggle around and do some lawyering about it.
Well, what I read, it said that actually that you should have a provision that allows you to assign the agreement, so that if something like that were to come along, that you would have that ahead of time, that in the non-compete that it would include a provision that allows the employee to assign the agreement to a purchaser of the business.
Yeah, you should, absolutely.
So, because if you ask them to do that after, you know, because you're contemplating selling the business, you better be offering them something else to do that, because otherwise they've got no incentive to do it and it may not be enforceable. So that really gets complicated. That's layers upon layers you have to look at when setting these non-competes up, if you're the one having someone sign them as opposed to the signee.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why you want to make sure that you're... attorney or whoever has some experience doing those kinds of things or has done them before or reads up on them really well, because there's some pitfalls for you in there if you want to get the desired effect. So as we were sitting here, I decided I'd pull up one of my previous non-competes that I had done before.
Oh, so this is a real life example, eh?
Yeah. And I was just kind of curious because you had mentioned something there about the errors and the signs. And I was like, I wonder if I put that on there. And it said, this agreement will be binding upon heirs, executors, administrators, and other legal representatives, and will be for the benefit of the company, its successors, and its assigns. So, I had that language in there. So,
for its assigns?
Assigns. Did I say assigns?
That tells you where the bathroom is. Anybody seen the assign? Oh, it's right down the hall.
And so I put that language in there. And the other thing that was in there, too, and this is the language I was talking to about getting an injunction, and since I pulled it up, I'll go ahead and read it. It says... I agree. What?
Since you pulled it up. I'll be doing that in here.
I agree that it would be impossible or inadequate to measure and calculate the company's damages from any breach of the covenants herein. Accordingly, I agree that if I breach any part of this agreement, the company will have available, in addition to any other right or remedy available, the right to obtain an injunction from a court of competent jurisdiction restraining such breach or threatened breach, and to specific performance of any such provision of this agreement. I further agree that no bond or other security shall be required in obtaining such equitable relief, and I hereby consent to the issuance of such injunction and to be ordering of the specific performance. So,
easy for you to say.
Yeah, not really. But anyway, so those are the kinds of language you want to put in there for those if you are the employer. If you're the employee, those are the kinds of things you don't want to put in there, because that's not what you want. So,
and besides, you're going to be confused reading all that.
Yeah, that's right.
Here to fours and therefore art thou.
So now the question becomes, are these things enforceable? And again, depends state by state, but in states where they are enforceable or not strictly construed, they're enforceable as to their time and place and manner, as long as they are reasonable. And that's the time, place, manner things. Actually, I didn't really see that in any state as the specific verbiage they say, but that's the basic theory. They have to be reasonable as to a period of time. They have to be reasonable as to a certain place or geographic location and for a certain kind of manner. So.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things that I saw in there that it said would make it unenforceable is, like, for example, a court is likely to refuse to enforce an agreement that prohibits an employee for competing for the rest of his or her life.
Oh, absolutely. And
contrast, many industries, a non-compete with a duration of 6 months will be considered reasonable and therefore enforceable.
Yeah. And it just depends on the kind of, work it is. And I have some examples here, so I'm going to go through those, and that'll probably illustrate it a bit more.
All right.
So, take for example, if you work as an executive at a paper supply company, say like maybe, I don't know, Dunder Mifflin?
Oh, can I be Michael Scott?
In more ways than one.
That's what she said.
And so, when you go to work at Dunder Mifflin, you agree not to take a job at a rival office supply company in Scranton, PA, in that region, for a period of 2 years. So depending on the interpretations of that state, that might be reasonable. So we're not going to really get into the time period as far as like that, because it really differs by state. In Florida, 2 years is pretty reasonable. Some places, probably 6 months is reasonable. But for example, just broadly, I'm using Pennsylvania as just as the example because I'm talking about Dunder Mifflin. So why not? So as I said, not taking a job at a rival office supply company in Scranton area for 2 years, probably reasonable. On the other hand, if you work at Dunder Mifflin and agree not to take any sales job whatsoever in the Scranton, PA for 2 years, that's probably not reasonable, because any sales job doesn't really
compete with them.
Yeah. The office supply does, but any sales job, say if you go to sell medical supplies, or you go to sell, you know, drugs legally.
Legal drugs.
Then that would be something that, why would you have a covenant not to compete? It wouldn't really be for any legitimate reason. Likewise, again, working at Dunder Mifflin and you agree not to take a job in the office supply in Scranton, PA ever, not for the rest of your life.
You're banished from the industry.
Yeah.
You are too good at it.
That's right, Michael Scott. Not reasonable there either, because like you said, it's for the rest of your life. And again, working at Dunder Mifflin, agree not to take a job in office supply anywhere for a year. And by anywhere, I mean anywhere in the world. Probably not reasonable.
The world doesn't compete with you in Scranton.
I think that's right. Probably not reasonable either.
Here's a little insider tip in the office product business.
What's that?
The actual paper is a loss leader.
It is.
Yes, you give that out basically at a loss to entice them to buy the other higher end things.
I am familiar with the loss leader terminology. I know what that is.
That's what copy paper is. That's your traditional loss leader.
I tried to do that with my law firm in Florida by doing wills very inexpensively.
Because everybody needs copy paper.
Everybody needs a will.
Yeah.
Get them in the door.
That's right. Everybody's going to die. And everybody's going to need something to print their will on.
So one interesting thing is that when you talk about the geographic region, and I think this came up when I was in law school, we were talking about it, and I can't remember what the upshot was of it was. But say if you're like a rocket scientist and you work at NASA and you sign some sort of covenant not to compete as a rocket scientist, well, where's the geographic region for that? Because, you know, basically...
China.
Yeah.
Russia.
So... You know, depending on what the area is, it can kind of fluctuate a little bit. So, you know.
Well, I would think there'd be certain things, certain smart people jobs that you couldn't make them non-compete because they're the only ones of their type. So you have to let them go do these things, or there's very few of them.
That's right. Or you pay them adequately so they don't want to leave.
That's true.
So, now, the interesting thing is that Florida courts and a lot of courts will rarely refuse to enforce a non-compete agreement due to its length or geographic scope. Basically, under Florida law and some other states, courts are required to blue pencil an impermissibly broad or lengthy non-compete agreement to make it reasonable within time limits. And that's according to Florida Statute 542.335.
So they can just arbitrarily reduce the time or the geography or something?
Yeah.
And hold it still enforceable, but just for a shorter period in a smaller area?
The court says, you know what, that's a little bit much. We're going to go ahead and chop this down a little bit.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do here. I'm going to write a number on a sheet of paper, and I'm going to slide that across the desk to you. What do you think about that, huh? Still going to be upset about that?
And actually, now that, you know, since I already have this thing pulled up, I had a clause in my non-compete that I did that I'm looking at here that basically says, in the event that any provision of the above relating to the time period and or territory covered shall be declared by a court of competent jurisdiction to exceed the maximum time period and or territory that deems reasonable and enforceable, that time period and or territory shall be deemed to be the maximum time period and or territory which that court deems reasonable and enforceable. So, basically it's saying, hey, you know what? By signing this, you're agreeing the court can do this too. So, I don't know that you need to put that in there because there is law on that, at least in Florida. But, not a bad idea to throw it in your non-compete anyway.
Just in case.
So, recently though, I think even in Florida, which I would say Florida is the opposite of California with non-competes. They are the place where it happens a lot, actually.
Man, that's just like opposite ends of the U.S. or something.
I know. Completely different.
Yeah.
It's like red versus blue.
Or east versus west.
Tupac versus Biggie.
Yep.
Celtics v. Lakers.
Miami v. San Francisco.
So you can do this all day long. So, yeah. But anyway, kind of interesting how there's depending on what state it is, there's a pretty broad area of law in here. So it really depends where you live.
So look up where you live and how they're enforced, if they're enforced at all. So if you're some states, if you're in the lucky 9 states that don't have it, I think it's 9 is what I read.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. There's
something
9
like that.
But, you know, it depends. If you're an employer,
then that's not so lucky.
Yeah, not so lucky. And I mean, the reason why I think that non-competes are maybe not such a bad thing with regards to certain things is that a lot of times these non-competes go hand in hand with some sort of like kind of trade secret type information, something that the person is privy to only because they're an employee. And it's almost like kind of a confidentiality thing too. They might have client lists, things like that. And also, I mean, it's understandable if an employer spends a lot of time training an employee to do a certain kind of job where they don't really know how to do it. And they might not even be very profitable during that period. It might take them a long time to try to get them up to speed to where they can be profitable.
Exactly.
So it's not really fair that they learn the nuts and the bolts of the operation.
And then leave.
Yeah, they run out and then basically become a competitor with you and then basically take the information that you taught them, probably at a loss, and steal your business.
That's right.
Might make you a little upset.
Very.
So there's two sides
to it. Like I say, there's been a couple of times in my business career where that's happened.
And yeah.
I wished I'd have had one of those.
So, I mean, yeah, there's reasons for them, but there's also reasons not to have them, too. So,
one of the other things they said that you've got to watch for when you're making them, depending on which side of this you're on,
yeah.
If you're looking to get out of it or if you're looking to make sure you don't miss anything, said a lot of businesses make the mistake of using a one-size-fits-all approach. A non-compete that is good for one business or industry could be ill-suited for another. Likewise, a non-compete that is crafted for use with a particular employee might be counterproductive if used with another. It is a mistake to use a one-size-fits-all or a boilerplate approach to a non-compete. And I noticed, you know, when I looked up some of this information on the internet, here was forms on the internet that you could pull up for a non-compete, just fill in dates and names.
Yeah.
And it's saying that most likely you're going to fail with something like that.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't take into account the state you're in, or even if it does, it doesn't take into account the industry, the talents, you know, things like that that are involved in it. So it said stay away from those. Take the time to have the non-compete specifically written up for your business and also keep it up. Even if you've got one right now, just because you've got one that's written for it right now, don't use it for 20 years and think things haven't changed, you know, with technology and everything else.
Well, the law changes too.
Yeah. So you got to stay on top of those things as a business.
What
if you want to keep them enforceable?
Yeah. What if you look at, you rely on this Florida statute, which says that courts will blue line or blue pencil these agreements to make them to the maximum available. And you say, well, you know what? I'll make it for 20 years for, you know, 15 state radius and blah, blah, blah. Because you know that the court will change it to the maximum allowed based on this law. What if the law changes and they say, nah, courts don't have to do that anymore. If you overextend yourself, it's just unenforceable.
Right.
You don't update it on that, then you're SOL, buddy.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's a good idea, yeah, to keep abreast of it. And really, and not just plugging my craft, but it's one of those things, you want to hire a lawyer. I mean, if you're going through the trouble of having employees, you want to try to protect them and make sure that they don't leave you and take things like that, you should definitely hire a lawyer to do that. So that's my 2 cents.
It's your 2 cents so that you can get your $200 an hour.
It's called fertilizer for the money tree.
That's right. Spreading the crap.
Touche.
Tucci. Well, I also, there was something I was interested in, and I didn't know I couldn't remember what it was called, but I went to look it up. And it's a special kind of non-compete. And it has to do with politicians.
Okay.
Have you heard of that?
No, I have not.
Well, politicians are under something called a revolving door restrictions. And what that means is you can't go from being a senator or a congressman or something like that right into being a lobbyist.
Ah.
Because, of course, there's lots of appearance of misconduct in those cases.
You don't say.
So they have, at the federal level, they have laws, and then certain states have it. Revolving door is a phrase that describes a practice of legislators leaving public service and heading immediately for lobbying positions. Oh, this is where I got the 9 states. Ethic laws in all but 9 states limit this practice by setting mandatory waiting periods before a legislator may register as a lobbyist or engage in lobbying activities. And among the states that provide for cooling off periods for former legislators, 26 require a 1-year gap between legislating and lobbying, and 10 states plus the Minnesota House set the waiting period for 2 years. That's for as far as states.
What did you call that, revolving whore?
That's probably more accurate. But then for federal ones, they also have federal ones that are in there. Federal personnel may be subject to certain conflict of interest restrictions on private employment activities even after they leave service for the United States government. These restrictions applicable when one enters private employment after having left federal government service. For the most part, other than narrow restrictions, I like the way this is very ambiguous. That kind of defines what you can do for the state ones. Mm-hmm. These federal ones are very ambiguous. They don't specifically tell you anything. For the most part, other than the narrow restrictions specific to procurement officials or bank examiners, these laws restrict only certain representational types of activities for private employers, such as lobbying or advocacy directed to and which attempt to influence current federal officers. So it says federal employees in the executive branch of government are restricted in performing certain post-employment representational activities for private parties. And they have, number one, a lifetime ban on switching sides. That is, representing a private party on the same particular matter involving identified parties on which the former executive branch employee had worked personally and substantially for the government. So in other words, you're working for the government preventing, say, a conglomerate from doing something, mm-hmm. and then you go immediately from your job on the government to working for that company to do it because you've got the inside information on what the government was using against you to turn around and give them to turn it over, like, say, drilling in, you know, the national forests or something like that.
Right.
That kind of thing. So you're forbidden for a lifetime for doing that to switch parties, you know, to the other side of a matter. A 2-year ban on switching sides on somewhat broader range of matters which were under the employee's official responsibility. A 1-year restriction on assisting others on certain trade or treaty negotiations. A 1-year cooling off period for certain senior officials barring representational communications to and attempts to influence persons in their former departments or agencies.
1 year?
1 year, yes. Hmm. 5 is a new 2-year cooling off period for very senior. They got all this in quotation marks, senior and very senior officials barring representational communications to and attempts to influence certain other high-ranking officials in the entire executive branch of government. And number 6, a 1-year ban on certain former high-level officials performing certain representational or advisory activities for foreign governments or foreign political parties. So they don't want you jumping right out. Now, they have them for the legislative branch, and most of those include a 1-year or 2-year that say you can't go to work for lobbyists and you can't go to work for foreign governments, which makes sense. But now here's one that's thrown in here that I really thought was interesting. These are not elected officials. These are officials in government positions, procurement personnel. They have this spelled out specifically for procurement, you know, personnel in federal agencies. And they're in their post-employment, they're limited to represent in federal agencies that are not only limited in their post-employment representational lobbying or advocacy activities on behalf of the private entities after leaving government service, but they're also prohibited from receiving compensation from certain private contractors for a period of time after being responsible for procurement action on certain large contracts as government officials. Procurement personnel also have additional rules on reporting contacts from prospective employers who are government contractors.
Yeah.
So that's what they're, I guess what they're saying is they're identifying the fact that there's a whole lot of possibility of misconduct with the guys that are spending these billions of taxpayer dollars.
Oh, no doubt.
On all these different projects. And, you know, you're working here for the government doing this. We only get paid so much working for the government. So now this guy offers you a job going to work for him, this conglomerate that wants to sell widgets to the government, if you can get the government to buy $80 billion worth of them.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we can do that. You stamp that contract and get it through. Now you go take a million-a-year job for him. Yeah. So there's a lot of opportunity for that, and they're trying to do it. But I think it's way insufficient, you know, those things that are in there that prohibit what you do after your time of service is up.
Well, one of the more serious uses of non-competes that I came across, I don't know if you read this article or not, Jimmy John's.
Jimmy John's? No.
The sandwich shop.
Yeah.
they had people who worked at Jimmy John's sign non-competes.
That they wouldn't go somewhere and make Jimmy John's sandwiches or make other... They couldn't go to work for Subway?
Basically, yeah. It's, I mean, it's pretty ridiculous if you think about it. They were honestly worried, I guess, that somebody might go work across the street at Subway. And, you know, they were going to lose clientele because the people followed their favorite sandwich artist across the street.
People don't follow a sandwich artist.
So, I mean, I think it's pretty reprehensible.
You might follow a tattoo artist, but you're not going to follow a sandwich artist because they make them all the same. They train them the same way to make it. There is no art in sandwich making. It's all a myth.
Yeah. So, basically, I think it's pretty down low and reprehensible, and it really irritated me when I found that out. So, but
I refuse to eat Jimmy John's.
Well, they've changed their policy now, so I've gone back.
Oh, so you're going.
Yeah. But,
you don't hold a grudge, huh?
Not when I can hold a sandwich. So basically, the agreement prohibited workers from, during their employment and for 2 years after, from working any other business that sells submarine, hero type, deli style pita and or wrapped or rolled sandwiches within 2 miles of any Jimmy John shop in the United States.
That's pretty bad.
It was. And they were actually sued by several states' attorneys general to prohibit them from doing this.
You know, you're going to go follow some minimum wage employee and tell him he can't have a job at Subway because you signed a non-compete. I can't imagine the profitability in that.
No. And that's just basically what they were doing is they were trying to
intimidate
and hold this over their head and keep them in this job.
If I can't get a job at Subway, I'm sunk. I'll just have to stay here and work forever.
I'll be sunk without that submarine.
And the screen doors on it.
Well, anyway, I thought that was kind of an interesting use of it and a ridiculous use of it.
It is an interesting use of it. You know, one other thing that I think that we ought to get into some point is lobbyist laws. I think that would be a good one to go over.
It would. I don't know anything about it. You should research all that.
I will. I will. I touched on part of it when I was looking this up and some of the things that our lobbyists do and the influence that money has in the policies we have to live with in this world.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's really ridiculous.
Oh, it's crazy.
Don't get me back up on that soapbox.
I know. You haven't been on in a while.
I know. They're about ready to grind my gears, though, on that when I read some of that stuff.
Speaking of soapbox, a nice little box from Dollar Shave Club recently.
Boy, I'll say. That was a soapbox.
Yeah.
Sent us all their products, all their different products, and
that's why I'm smelling so good. I put a little dab of their beard oil on.
You said that was bourbon.
I drank the bourbon.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it was a nice box.
Sure was.
I think that's going to bring us to...
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we go over different legal terms that we talked about. And I'm going to quiz Tommy today on some non-competes and see what he remembers.
I remember it all.
What are some different names for non-competes?
Different names for non-competes.
I said it. You made a comment about it.
Non-competes? Non-disclosures?
Sounds really serious.
Oh, yeah, I remember saying that. I remember what I said. I just don't remember what you said.
A covenant not to compete.
Yeah, that's it.
Or
there's a devil one.
Or a restrictive covenant.
Restrictive covenant. Man, those covenants are coming in there strong.
Yeah, and that's just some different terminology for it. And depending on where you are, I mean, it could be used interchangeably. Now, in order for these to be enforceable, what do they have to be?
Well, they have to be specific in time and geography, and they also have to be given proper consideration up front.
That's right. And also, one more thing is the manner in which the restriction applies. So, for example, if you are someone who sells paper, then...
You have to be restricted to selling paper.
That's right.
Not just selling pencils.
Or maybe even office supplies. You know, something reasonable is really the key there.
But not Subways.
Not Subways. And there's a Florida law which says if these restrictions are too broad, they're allowed to blue line them. What does that mean?
That means they're allowed to change them and make them what they deem to be reasonable limits.
That's right. I don't know if you know what a blue line
was. I even remembered the blue line. I thought that was what you were going to look for, and I was getting ready to say it. Disappointed me when you said it.
Now, there's one profession that had the foresight to determine that Non-competes.
Foreskin?
No. No. That would not be a good idea to have those in their profession, because they were thinking about that. Who would that be?
That would be the legal profession. That's because right. There's no honor amongst thieves.
Yeah, lawyers don't have non-competes, so you get to take your clients with you.
That's right. Take them all with you, right straight to hell.
All my clients.
Well, all lawyers are going to hell. That's what I always heard.
You think so?
Yeah.
What does it make the courthouse?
The whorehouse.
Well, that's going to do it for Legal Briefs. You did pretty well.
I did, except for not remember the covenant stuff.
You know, if you heard the term covenant not to compete, you'd put two and two together.
Or else I might think about Rosemary's Baby or something.
You think?
Yeah. That was a dark covenant.
Your mother sews socks in hell.
That was the Exorcist.
That was the edit.
Yeah.
That wasn't actually what she said in the movie, I don't think.
I know. I know what she said. I saw the movie when it originally came out.
It's kind of like Rosemary's Baby, right?
No, not exactly.
Same time period?
It's pretty much the same time period, yeah.
They're kind of mashed together in my brain.
No, two completely different movies.
Yeah, well, I get that, but okay. Don't you have anything else funny to say?
Not when you put me on the spot. Coffee break's over. Back on your heads.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.